This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Basically bizarre behavior, like ordering aides to track down a special scented moisturizer from the Ritz Hotel, as well as his pursuit of a discount used Trump Hotel mattress. These are real things I'm saying.
Pruitt, in many ways, was sort of like President Trump, even though he didn't have the great wealth of President Trump.
Pruitt's ouster is an unbelievable development in that he lasted this long.
Well, Scott Pruitt is doing a great job within the walls of the EPA. I mean, we're setting records.
So Trump always sort of seemed to sort of be in his camp, even though the things he was doing were so hard to justify.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. So we lost another noble soldier in the battle to corrupt this entire once great nation with sepsis. Spare a thought today for fallen Scott Pruitt, former head of the Environmental Protection Agency, who resigned yesterday. He gave the fight for corruption all he had. Delusional climate denier, hater of women and gays, taker of money from giant fossil fuel companies. He went much further into sin on a practical level. Let's review. As of last month, he was under at least 14 separate federal investigations by the Government Accountability Office. And for someone so principled when it comes to uterine happenings, Pruitt held himself to a considerably lower standard. He rented a DC condo at bargain basement rates from a lobbyist whose clients were regulated by the EPA. That looks a hell of a lot like a bribe. Pruitt also gave weird, unjustified raises to his pals and spared them conflict of interest pledges. He also proposed spending $100,000 a month on a charter aircraft membership, and he longed for a $43,000 phone booth. He also had the EPA regularly swept for bugs in his office and installed biometric locks on his office doors at a cost of around $9,000. He tried to set his wife up with a huge order from Chick-fil-A, or maybe a whole Chick-fil-A franchise, and he did some creepy Trumpish favors for his daughter. Pruitt also used agency staff to run errands for him, such as, I hate this part, buying a mattress for his, quote, personal use. And getting him his favorite moisturizer. Almost as soon as he arrived at the EPA, he asked his security detail to use flashing lights and sirens when they were stuck in DC traffic. Super heroic form of entitlement. And so a wholesome public servant, our Scott Pruitt, rolling up his sleeves, working hard to protect the environment and hard for the American people. Good riddance, Pruitt. I hope to God you're not the next Attorney General. Today's topic on TrumpCast is South Africa. My guest, Andries du Toit, is an academic and activist in Cape Town. He was part of the resistance to apartheid beginning when he was a child in the 60s and 70s. Later, as an historian, he traced the origins of apartheid and the rise of the National Party, which, yes, he likens to the rise of Trumpism in the United States. It's an extraordinary story he tells and a suggestive one, but as he himself says, historical analogies are always imperfect. I'll be back with Andries in just a minute.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune in to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Each week, we bring you stock market outlooks, macroeconomic updates, and investment strategies that can help you succeed. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience about how they navigate uncertain markets. Prepare to be engaged, enlightened, and entertained by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
Joining me on the line is Andreas du Toit. He's a researcher and writer at the University of Western Cape in South Africa. He's also the director of PLOS, which studies poverty, inequality, and social justice in Southern Africa. Welcome, Andreas.
It's a pleasure.
As you know, you came to my attention when I saw a thread you did on Twitter about analogies that I hadn't heard spelled out between the situation in the United States and the rise of apartheid in South Africa. And it was very striking. You know, we've heard a lot of comparisons and templates on this show put forth from 20th century Europe. And yeah. Those are so freighted. And they're also longer ago than apartheid, which is in my memory. And also, you know, South Africa is an English-speaking, partly English-speaking former colony. Why don't you spell out the analogy? And I know you were very tentative with making historical analogies, but why don't you spell out the analogy that you put forth in this thread?
Yeah, well, I suppose what came to mind for me in this thread, this was just after the resignation of your Supreme Court Judge Kennedy. I was trying to sort of give voice to my own quite uneasy sense, which I've had for the last year and a half, really, about what I find quite worrying about what's happening in the United States at the moment. Now I'm not talking about a period that I was part of. I was only born in the 1960s. But my postgraduate research as a student of history was looking at the South African 1940s and 1950s. And it was very interesting for me to see how many echoes there were between what I'm seeing in the United States right now and my experience of going back to the archives and reading the newspapers of the progressive opinion and enlightened and liberal opinion as they unfolded from 1945 onwards. I don't know how much your listeners know about South African history, and it's very difficult to condense all of this into sound bites, but I can try to sort of capture some of it.
Yeah, maybe you know, this point you had about the mainstream press in the 40s and 50s, that what you saw in that were, you say, people sleepwalking into a battlefield. And yeah. I think of Leon Wessels, who, you know, a member of the National Party, who during the apartheid years, one of the few Afrikaner politicians who publicly apologized for his role. And he talked about his deafness to the crying and laughter of South Africans during apartheid. And he said, "I'm sorry I've been so hard of hearing for so long." So I think of the sleepwalking and the deafness as maybe two components.
Actually, yeah. If I can sketch to you a little bit about what I think was going on in South Africa in the 1940s.
Yes.
And then what happened in the 1950s. South Africa in the 1940s was very much a colonial and white supremacist society. It was a welfare state for whites. And it was a society in which black people and African people were seen as mostly being tribal. They lived in the rural areas. They had nothing to do, or supposedly had very little to do with white civilization. They didn't belong in the towns. The equivalent of Jim Crow legislation, they had very limited political rights. But if you go to the 1940s, what's interesting about South Africa is that it was a time in which progressives and liberals had a very strong sense that history was on the move. There was a lot of optimism. And at the same time, there was a sense that progress was coming to South Africa, very much brought by capitalism. The Second World War, a period in which large numbers of black people and African people had streamed into the cities and had become factory workers. They had actually demanded labor rights. They'd gone on strike. And they were strong movements to grant workers' rights to African workers as well, to grant them unemployment insurance. So there was a sense that in South Africa, economic progress would bring about social integration. And that in a way, it was a very simple choice. You either had to get with the program or to resist it. And what nobody saw coming was a kind of backlash of conservative white resistance. You might say it was born of white economic anxiety. Poor white Afrikaners, mostly from the rural people, who felt threatened by any kind of talk of integration or equality or democracy or any kind of extension of equal rights to workers. Mm-hmm. That's really what apartheid was. Apartheid was, in a way, the white population doubling down on white supremacy at a historical moment at which it seemed that some kind of demographic process might be pushing it back. So that is one of the places where there's some interesting resonances.
Yes, not unlike during the Obama years, the feeling that racism was in decline and that there were all of a sudden new, even unbelievable opportunities for people of color in the United States, and that we had almost vanquished racism. Of course, that wasn't true.
And that there would be a demographic dividend on which the Democratic Party could bargain, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think people underestimated the seriousness of the backlash that came. It was very much seen as a glitch. And as I pointed out in my rant on Twitter, the National Party victory also seemed like a electoral glitch. Only 37% of voters voted for the National Party in 1948. They only managed to construct a parliamentary majority by entering into an alliance with another party, the Afrikaner Party. But it seemed quite electorally tenuous. And they had this mad policy, apartheid, which nobody really thought was anything serious. It seemed to be some kind of attempt to hold on to the past.
And the glitch, explain a little bit more of the glitch and the Afrikaner Party, because it is interesting to see how also politically and procedurally there's disarray that precedes, you know, we always think that there's economic chaos, like Weimar, that gives rise to fascism. But in some cases, it's that, you know, in our country, so much gerrymandering and the confusion of the electoral college, you end up with minority rule.
Yeah, the South Africa was actually in a time of relative prosperity. It was not like the Weimar Republic, mm-hmm. but rural whites felt anxious. And the way in which our parliamentary seats were calculated, much like your electoral colleges, gave much more weight to the rural areas. Mm-hmm. So even though the National Party didn't have a majority of votes, they got the majority of seats. The United Party was convinced that it would be able to win back power in the next election, which would be 1953. But I think this is really the second interesting thing for me, is that the United Party was never able to mount a convincing fight back against apartheid. It was never able to put clear blue water between itself and the National Party, because the dreadful truth is that the United Party, at the end of the day, was also a party for white supremacy. It just wanted kinder, gentler white supremacy. And there was a sort of a critical exchange between the leader of the National Party, D.F. Malan, and the former prime minister, who was now the leader of the opposition, General Smuts, in which Malan said to Smuts, "Well, come on, admit it. You also stand for apartheid. You're just not as honest and as forthright about it as we." And Smuts had to admit it. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the United Party was unable to say, actually, if we are at a crossroads, we have to forego white supremacy altogether, and we have to go all out and say, we are for racial equality. General Smuts, even though he had been part of the Declaration of Human Rights, the drafting of the preamble to the Declaration of Human Rights, he was a racist. He looked down on black people and on Indians, and he could not bring himself to accept the principle of racial equality. So the United Party was, in the end, electorally outflanked, and most of white opinion went over to the National Party, and the white electorate enthusiastically supported apartheid at the end of the day.
You identified yourself and your family as dissident Afrikaners. I have to admit that while I did a few protests in favor of divestment, sleeping in shanties, I don't know if you followed this at all on college campuses in the 1990s, mm-hmm. but I didn't realize that there was a cohesive group of dissident Afrikaners, of an opposition who opposed the apartheid government. What was that experience, and were you sort of born into this resistance?
My parents had been very much part of the first generation of white Afrikaans people to get a university education. But, and it's no credit to me, but during the 1960s, they came to be, I think even at the very beginning of the 1960s, they came to be disgusted and appalled by what the National Party government was doing. I was not there at the time. This was before I was born. In my family's history, my mother was a teacher, and she taught mostly in black and colored schools and became colleagues with black and colored teachers who she became quite close friends with. And in a way, in that way, our family contacted and made connections with a black resistance against apartheid. So by the time that I was born, that was 1965, my parents were quite firmly opposed to what was going on. By the time that I got my sort of understanding of the world, which was in the 1970s, that was during the very beginnings of the dawn of black consciousness in South Africa, the murder of Steve Biko, the assassination of Rick Turk, all those things were going on. So it was a very confusing and a very odd time to, you know, come of age as a young white teenager, suddenly realizing that the normal society around you was not something you could be part of. I think my earliest memory, if I may share this, was I was a small boy. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I could not read, and I saw a sign on a park bench, and I was trying to decipher it, and I asked my mom, well, what is the sign saying? And she refused to tell me. And later it turned out this was a sign was saying white people only could sit on the bench, and that was the first time that I realized that we were part of a society that denied black people, a society that denied black people such basic rights.
And comforts, yeah.
So it is quite a... And I think the thing is, that was what... It's another thing that prompted me to write this little tweet storm of mine, is there was a very powerful process for me, which was when I was 16, 17, 18 years old and realizing I am a conscript in the army. I'm expected to fight for this army and to kill black people who are standing up for their political rights. And you have to make a choice. And that choice is going to affect your career. That choice is going to affect whether or not you get certain kind of jobs. It's not just theory. It's not just signing a petition. It's actually a choice which has very real consequences. And it's a frightening process to resist an authoritarian state.
This is the SADF, and you were a conscientious objector, more or less.
Yeah. I was part of
more than that. You burned your draft card.
I was part of a wild and a hot-headed young group of people who came to be known as the Cape Town 23. Mm. And we publicly declared that we were never going to fight for apartheid, and that they could come and jail us if they wanted to. So that was a defining and a very frightening moment for me, where in a way it was about all of us saying with our bodies, you know, we are not going to be part of this.
Yeah.
And I think in a way what I see happening in the States is many people on the edges of that society are discovering that, and many people who are not white have been in that place all their lives, knowing what it's like to come up against the state that's willing to use repressive force against you. Mm-hmm. Resisting an authoritarian government is not a game. You know, I'm very struck by this debate that's happening in your society around civility.
Yeah.
And I completely understand the revulsion against the notion that you have to be civil in your position to such vile policies. But that doesn't mean saying fuck Trump is the resistance. There's a lot of sort of wild talk on the left in the States that seems to be quite performative. I think the real thing is going to be when people have to make real decisions about the choices in that in their lives that affect their future.
Well, one of the choice, because most of the South Africans I know are in the United States, the choice that I'm most familiar with was the, you know, so-called brain drain, or all the families that left in the 70s and 80s. Why didn't you make that choice? And why did other people make that choice?
Well, I mean, we were South Africans and we were not going to leave. This is our country. And even now in South Africa, we are facing very real problems. We now have a democratic government that is has got very serious problems of corruption. There's all kinds of hot-headed talk of expropriating white land without compensation. There's a lot of anger. A lot of white people are wanting to leave right now, but some of us have taken the decision that we are South Africans and we are here to stay. So I'm not sure whether there's any kind of parallels with the position in the United States.
Well, I haven't heard much talk of leaving, but there's certainly a big gap between those who are making some effort to resist even politically or through activism, and most of, as you would say, white society who are trying to pretend it's not happening. That is what you cite in this thread as some of the worst cognitive dissonance that really compounded the anguish of that time, that there was, you say, Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy was the, you know, sort of number one song on the charts in the 80s and 90s, was it? And that this sort of emphasis as you were passing through roadblocks or contending with riot cops while your parents' friends were being arrested, monotonous yeah. insistence that everything was all right. That seems to be around right now. Yeah. And even to say it's not all right is to risk violating the don't worry, be happy norm.
Yeah, don't worry, be happy was the one big hit, and the other one was Midnight Oil song, Beds Are Burning. I don't know whether that ever charted in the US, How Can We Sleep While Our Beds Are Burning, which was much more close to the temper of the times. I don't know. I think in a way the risks and the stakes are very different in the United States and the US. Mm-hmm. In the US, it is people of color, immigrants, and poorer women who are in the crosshairs and whose reproductive rights are being threatened. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's what's a little bit scarier in the US is that it might be very much easier for a right-wing government to sort of divide up freedom and to create a mollycoddled group of relatively privileged white people who feel everything is fine while everybody else's rights get violated. So I think that's quite a frightening procedure. In South Africa, in the end, what happened is that everybody realized either things have to change or we're all going to go down. I'm not sure whether that moment will arrive in the same way in the United States. It seems to me that the hope that you can go back to a sort of golden age of the Clintons or of Obama is a mistake. I think you have to find new strategies and ways of not trying to pass over differences, but perhaps win some battles and force some issues to resolution might be what is required.
So activism, grassroots activism, up to and including, you know, real agitation, not to say clashes and rioting, it would be part of it. Another would be simply political solutions and voting. What about media? I know that there was, obviously, our president has threatened the media and has complained bitterly about it, and in some cases threatened Jeff Bezos, possibly because he owns the Washington Post. But South Africa really did suppress the media. How did that, in your memory, because you had studied you've now studied the media in the 50s, 40s and 50s, but then how did that transition happen, and how did people get news in that time, including you?
Well, the processes of political change were very different. In South Africa, a very large part of the struggle happened off stage and not in the media, but it happened through popular uprising in the townships, in communities that were in a way not mediated at all. It happened without the help of newspapers. A lot of the organizing was face-to-face, house-to-house, etc. The alternative media played a very important role. There were some newspapers that have played a very important role, particularly in getting the word out to the international context, and we could even get some Americans to be part of divestment campaigns, etc., which was of immense importance.
Was it important? I couldn't tell.
It's really important. In a way, what happened was that apartheid got to be made unworkable, partly because of poor black South Africans rising up against it and simply making the townships ungovernable. Mm-hmm. And secondly, because the economic context of apartheid became insupportable. Mm-hmm. And the business community, which in the 1960s and 1970s had been quite comfortable with apartheid, came to believe that this political situation had to be, quote unquote, normalized, as people would put it. Mm-hmm. So the media was a very important part of that process. But we are today in a very different media environment. What happens in the Washington Post and the New York Times is of less importance when you have sort of large sections of the population that believe that Hillary Clinton has been running a pedophile ring out of a pizza restaurant in downtown Washington.
Yeah.
So in a way, who decides what is news and what is true is a very much more contested terrain, and that is uncharted at the moment. And that's a very alarming part of the scene we're seeing at the moment in the United States, in the UK, and elsewhere.
And I'm going to let you go because I know it's so late there. But one of the figure that struck me most in your thread was 40 years. That it lasts a long time, and even in the case of South Africa, it's been 25 years since the end of apartheid, and the country's still struggling with its consequences and after effects. Most people flagged your threat as terrifying, and I did too.
Yeah.
But there's something, it adds less hysteria and more rigor, I think, to the historical analysis of what's happening in the United States. And I'm very grateful to you for that.
Yeah, and I would just say, stop. In these moments, the question is not how to return to what was. The question is to try to discern what is coming, what is trying to be born here. And it may be a very different kind of political dispensation. I think the geopolitical fix that delivered a sort of welfare states for parts of the American working class in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, that New Deal, it will never come back. Mm. What is the viable and sustainable future for which Democrats and excluded people and marginalized people can fight now? That, I think, is the question to which all of us want an answer.
Andries du Toit, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Hey, I've got two points of business. First, are you a member of Slate Plus? Because by joining Slate Plus, you can get ad-free podcasts, bonus segments, and all kinds of other cool stuff. So go to slate.com/TrumpCastPlus. That's slate.com/TrumpCastPlus to join the great Slate Plus. And my second point of business is, are you following us on Twitter? We're at Real Trumpcast. That's at Real Trumpcast. Follow us on Twitter for all things Trumpcast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to today's show.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.